Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
You just look around the world. We are in turbulent times, let's say. And, you know, what can we do as a community locally that makes a difference?
Stephen Hale says trying to improve the health, sustainability, and efficiency of our local food system can improve lives at home and around the world. That's why he's a member of the Bloomington Food Policy Council. I speak with him and Michael Simmons about the group's goals. Can a CSA be too big? That's the question Harvest Public Media looks at today. Then two types of chicken in the kitchen, Caribbean grilled chicken and chicken of the woods mushrooms. Here are our food news headlines, courtesy of Lou Ann Johnson.
We'll start off with the latest from India. Police arrested the headmistress of a school where 23 children died after eating a meal laced with pesticides. She has been missing for more than a week. Forensic tests showed that the meal was contaminated with a lethal pesticide banned in many countries. Authorities have said the headmistress is key to solving the mystery of how the pesticide ended up in the food. India's free school lunch program had already drawn widespread complaints over food safety. The U.S. is now second in world obesity rates. That's according to a report by the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations. Mexico now holds the top distinction, where 32.8% of citizens are overweight. The main author of the UN report blamed increased urbanization for the shift, with more sedentary jobs and a higher concentration of commercially available snack food. Childhood obesity in Mexico is being called a very serious epidemic. The rate has tripled in 10 years. Now 1 in 3 Mexican teenagers could be classified as obese. Colonel Sanders has retired from his post on the signs of newer KFC restaurants. In an effort to rebrand and update, the restaurant has announced it will create a more upscale chain called KFC 11. The name is a reference to the 11 herbs and spices in KFC's original recipe. The move comes in response to changing tastes, as young consumers are shunning fast food for fast casual chains like Chipotle and Panera. KFC 11 will offer flatbreads, rice bowls, and only boneless chicken. KFC is by no means the first fast food restaurant to undertake rebranding efforts in the last few years. Burger King has already dropped its iconic king after market research found that consumers thought he was creepy. McDonald's has retired Ronald McDonald's sidekicks, the Hamburglar and Grimace. While the company doesn't plan to kick Ronald to the curb, too, the happy clown has taken a back seat in modern marketing. And news from another fast food chain. Taco Bell has announced this week that it's getting rid of its kids' meals and the toys that come with them at its U.S. locations. According to a spokesman, the decision was a financial one. The items will begin to come off menus starting this month and should be completely gone by January 2014. With the decision, Taco Bell has become the first nationwide chain to voluntarily stop selling kids' meals with toys. Find links to these complete stories on our website, eartheats.org, and find out about the latest food news as soon as we do. Follow us at twitter.com/eartheats.
Lou Ann Johnson, thanks for the news.
See you next week.
Community-supported agriculture, or CSAs, allow consumers to buy shares of eggs, meat, fruit, and veggies from a farm at the beginning of the season. Most operations are small, serving dozens of customers. Others serve hundreds. Today we ask the question whether a CSA can become too big. Reporting for Harvest Public Media, Grace Hood shares the story of the rise and fall of one of the country's largest CSA programs, an organic farm in northern Colorado.
It'll take years for Andy Grant, former owner of Grant Family Farms, to sift through all the paperwork he's accumulated over the decades.
Yep. Seed catalogs. We've got a nursery folder. This is a CSA.
Grant inherited the farm from his dad, who started it in the 50s. The Grant Family Farm CSA was launched in 2007 with 127 members. By last year, it peaked with more than 5,000. Still, about 80% of the operation was growing vegetables for sale in grocery stores and other commercial outlets. The business had its ups and downs, Grant says, and at the end of 2011, the farm needed an infusion of cash.
So we're a little short of capital to... We had the CSA crops already in the ground. There was just no question the CSA was going to work. But would we have enough money to grow the wholesale crops?
Grant accepted a $1.5 million loan from a consortium of investors called Localization Partners. But by December 2012, the farm declared Chapter 7 bankruptcy, which effectively ended operations.
You know, the sad part is we have lost our family's farm. But I'll leave that as... the only negative.
There are two different views on why Grant Family Farms declared bankruptcy. Andy Grant says when he had to leave his farm finances to Localization Partners, that's when it started accelerating unnecessarily down a road toward bankruptcy. But Localization Partners sees it differently.
Take a look at their debt.
Tom Abood is one of the Localization investors who had a stake in Grant Family Farms. He says with almost $10 million in liabilities, there didn't seem to be many options. As the Chapter 7 proceedings continue, Localization will recoup some of its losses. But Grant Family Farms CSA is done. Ultimately, Abood wonders whether the CSA growth was sustainable and if the operation grew too complex.
With some of the other CSAs, that's primarily what they do. So they don't have a wholesale. They're really looking at the CSA to finance their operation. So I think sometimes big is not necessarily better.
Grant Family Farms had dozens of distribution points across Colorado's Front Range, from Colorado Springs in the south to the northern Wyoming border. That's compared to a smaller operation where members might pick up their share every week from the farm. John Hendrickson is a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and studies small vegetable farms.
If you're really going to take seriously the community component of it, and if one of your goals is to have strong ties with your members and have your members have strong ties with you, you know, maybe there is a point where the CSA can't really get any bigger.
But that argument doesn't hold water for Andy Grant, who says his CSA was profitable until the end.
So, you know, is the litmus test that you can only grow for 100 people, well, that's not going to feed people. There are 4 million people that live in the Front Range of Colorado.
Already, he's starting up a new CSA called Six Dog Farms on a small ranchito untouched by the bankruptcy proceedings. Starting out, there are thousands of hens. Grant lost the previous flock in the bankruptcy proceedings. He says friends helped him finance the purchase of about 15,000, a $65,000 price tag.
After the how Grant Family Farms was decimated, we didn't have any money.
Along with egg shares, Six Dog will offer mushroom, cheese, fruit, and microgreen shares, mostly provided by other vendors. While the venture is spearheaded by Andy Grant, Josh Hall is managing the day-to-day affairs.
And so starting from scratch, we need to narrow that scope and see what those things are, not only that we do good, but what are the things that we do best.
In the coming weeks, Hall and Grant will transition the CSA name from Six Dog back to Grant Farms, having just regained access to the rights through bankruptcy court. They say they have no grand ambitions for the size of the operation, but just in a matter of months, they've brought in about 100 members. Share deliveries were expected to start mid-June. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Grace Hood.
Read and listen to more stories from the reporting team at Harvest Public Media on their website, harvestpublicmedia.org. From growers to consumers and restaurants to waste collection agencies, the food system is made up of many different entities. The Bloomington Food Policy Council hopes to bring these disparate pieces together into a cohesive whole. Sounds logical, but according to Michael Simmons, chair of the BFPC, this is a unique idea for the area. He was joined in the Earth Eat studios by Stephen Hale, co-chair of the advocacy work group on the BFPC. With the Bloomington Community Farmers Market as vibrant and well-attended as it is, Hale says we can have a skewed perspective on the health of our overall local food system.
Yeah, talking to people at the city, the farmers market is described as growing exponentially, which is fabulous good news, but is still a very small part, and I don't know specific numbers, but a small part of the overall food system that we have. And other aspects that I think are important to focus on include the concept of food literacy, really understanding our food, where it comes from. And I'll use an example of a dear friend of mine I was talking to a couple of weeks ago who said she was not comfortable buying eggs from a farm stand. You know, it's like, you know, have they been clean, handled right, whatever. Whereas if she goes into the big supermarket and they're in this crate with the expiration date on it, well, that's safe food. And I can understand why people have that point of view. But again, I think it points out a need for some better understanding, awareness of just where our food comes from, differences in food nutrition, things like that.
I just did a quick Google search to see what other cities across the country have a food policy council. Knoxville, Tennessee, I think was one of the first ones that popped up.
That's right. That's one of the first ones that came into existence.
Really?
Back in the 80s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Portland. What else? Oakland, California. Big foodie spot in Oakland. Are you using a city like one of these as a model for what we're doing here in Bloomington?
We're using a number of them, and actually even beyond the United States. When we were creating the food charter, we looked very carefully at the food charter for Toronto, which is one of the real flagship systems. We're also working together with New Haven, which has a food policy council that's very active, and they've created a – over a period of 6 years, they've created a food action plan, which is kind of the next step down the road for our council, which lays out specific goals and strategies and even down to the task level of what needs to be accomplished in order to create a sustainable food system.
Well, we've got two laptops out. I think, Stephen, you've got a paper copy of the strategic plan and the charter. As you're listening to this, if you want to go online and read it for yourself, their website is bloomingtonfpc.org, bloomingtonfpc.org if you want to follow along. So I'm curious to talk about the farmer aspect of the farmers market. One of the points on the strategic plan is to increase the number of growers. We can't have too many people growing their own food. I'm sure that's, you know, that would be a great problem to have if we had too much local food being produced. But this area, do we truly need more growers?
We do. Actually, if we look at the Bloomington Community Farmers Market, although it is a market that only sells food that is produced in Indiana, the farmers who come there to sell actually come from many, many counties throughout the central and southern parts of the state. So there are few of those who are actual local Monroe County growers, and there could be many, many more. And we certainly want to encourage more local growers, both because we want a secure food system in our immediate community, but also for sustainability reasons. So anytime you have the transportation of foods over long distances, there is an impact on the carbon footprint. There's also the chance that the nutritional quality of the food will deteriorate in the time that it's being transported. So for all those reasons, we would like to have the food produced as locally as possible.
I will just say it is a core belief of mine that anything we can do that will expand and strengthen our local food system is really important for the long-term welfare of our community. You just look around the world. We are in turbulent times, let's say. And, you know, what can we do as a community locally that makes a difference? And the more you look at the food issue and how it interfaces environmentally, energy, the things Michael was talking about, it can make a big difference. And at the same time, it's encouraging to see more happening. You know, just walking across town to the interview, I saw a couple of really lovely backyard gardens bumper to bumper in late July. So a lot of it's happening of its own will, which is great to see.
Also looking at the strategic plan, I mean, you've got some lofty goals listed here, one of which is supporting a community-wide composting program. Programs like that are off the ground in Seattle and San Francisco, these bigger cities on the West Coast. The idea of getting it going in Bloomington would be great. would require some cooperation, some significant cooperation with the city and the county probably. Can you talk about how that relationship is going?
I think there is a good relationship there. There's certainly a willingness on the part of many city council members to address issues of sustainability and the recognition that there are significant issues to be addressed. And they've already had presentations given to them by students from IU who were interested in looking at a citywide composting system. So they're aware of the possibilities. They're also aware of the problems. And we have not yet begun to work on that specific part of the strategic plan, but it's certainly there. And as a part of that, you may have noticed there's also the promotion of backyard composting while we're working on the larger issue of citywide composting.
And I guess what I'll add to that, as you know, composting is near and dear to my heart.
Yes, yes. You both were here, last year talking about composting?
That's right. Yep. But just looking at our community, I just sense a lot of pent-up demand, desire to get food composting going.
So let's fast forward several years. Say we get a curbside composting program off the ground in the city of Bloomington. Let's dispel some myths, because I know people out there are concerned about smell, the fact that it's going to attract pests to their curbside, any number of other concerns people have about putting food scraps on the street corner. Go.
Those aren't just myths. Those are things that can happen. If you don't manage the waste properly, you will see pests. You can have objectionable smells. And so it's about designing a program where, you know, you try to minimize the number of times things are handled. And at the same time, there's other things that need to get blended, particularly with food waste. So you have a good balanced compost, and that blending also tends to control smells and objectionable things from happening.
So again, it would require some education for people.
Absolutely.
To really
and that's been one of the things that I've been very impressed with is in the classes that I've taught on composting in the community, people have come back after taking the class and say, that was just what I needed. My compost is working now for the first time in years. So in many cases, it's just getting the information to the people who need it, and then they can take care of the rest.
And I'll just say why I am a member of the Food Policy Council. It is because the council has the food system perspective, the food system context, which is really hard to find. You know, you'll find restaurant associations, grower associations, public health. I mean, there's so many things out there that have pieces of the system. But I think it's something that does cry out for a real system approach and definition. It just seems to be an area where that is ripe for further work.
And it's one that I think government has a significant role to play in. In the World Watch Institute State of the World 2013, it stated governments need to do more to recognize the inherent right of every human being to safe, affordable, and healthy food and back up that right with appropriate policies. And I think that's where the emphasis really is. If we have the appropriate policies in place, everything else will follow from that.
Thanks for coming in. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks,
Our
Annie.
Pleasure.
Glad to be here.
Learn more about the Bloomington Food Policy Council on their website, bloomingtonfpc.org. And as we mentioned, Michael Simmons and Stephen Hale gave us great beginner, intermediate, and advanced knowledge about composting in a conversation last year. Read and listen to that on our website, eartheats.org. Coming up,
after you take off the chicken from the grill, the Caribbeans aren't finished with it. Okay, and what they do to finalize it, a little more lime juice, okay, a little sea salt, okay, and then I'm going to add just a little bit of smoked paprika just because I love it.
A taste of the Caribbean today. Chef Daniel Orr uses some techniques he learned while working in Anguilla on this grilled chicken breast. Before that, a different kind of chicken gets the Orr treatment. Stay with us. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, therapeutic massage, and Hatha Yoga, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. Memberships and gift certificates available. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Keep an eye on your shoes the next time you go on a summer hike in the woods. You might step on dinner if you're not too careful. Chanterelles are popping up in all their bright orange glory. Look for another brightly colored fungi this time of year, chicken of the woods. Along with morels and puffballs, these mushrooms are called the foolproof four because they're easy to identify and they don't have many poisonous lookalikes. Chef Daniel Orr is doing just about the most simple preparation in our first recipe.
Well, we've got some chicken of the woods mushrooms. These are, they really do have the taste and texture of chicken.
Mmm, you're right.
Aren't those delicious? What we do is we braise them. A lot of other mushrooms you wouldn't add this much liquid to, but these kind of slow cook, and they can tend to be a little bit dry, but when you cook them in a little bit of chicken stock or a little bit of vegetable stock, they absorb the moisture. You can finish it with a little bit of butter. And they have this really nice bright yellow bottom and kind of an orangey lobster shell colored top. And they keep in the refrigerator quite well for a week or two.
So when did you find these?
These were found by a guy who works at FHB, the Firehouse Broadcasting, and he called me and said, what do I do with these mushrooms? So I told him, and he said, well, you know, it seems like a lot of work. Why don't you just have them? So I said, yeah, I'll take them.
It's good to have friends.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Throughout the year, different people call me. They'll have a tree full of cherries, or a churchyard had a pear tree in it and nobody wanted the pears. So, you know, I was serving churchyard pears at the restaurant. So a lot of fun. Mm. One more for you?
Yes, please.
It's hot.
Gosh, it's good. Chef Orr learned some local tricks when he worked in the Caribbean, like rubbing raw chicken breast with a lot of lime juice. He says it might have started off as a way of preserving the meat, but now it just tastes like the Caribbean. Add some jalapenos, habaneros, and a small mountain of diced garlic, and you've got a really flavorful bird. He let the meat marinate in the various herbs and spices for a couple hours, and now he's ready to toss it on the grill, along with some other goodies.
All right, so we got our chicken nice and marinated. And I also brought out some heirloom tomatoes. We're going to throw those on the grill, get them a little charred
Excellent.
Up. Okay, I'm going to kind of shake off the excess marinade. And then we'll put that on the flesh side.
So now tell me the secret of cooking the perfect chicken breast so that it's not dry.
First off, starting with a marinade like we did is really, really important. Then you want to, you don't want to keep flipping it over and back. You know, you want to just basically mark it on both sides and then turn your heat down and cook it slowly so you don't get it burnt. So it takes a little longer, but that's what it takes to make a perfect chicken breast. Okay, and you see some of those peppers and the herbs are falling on the grill, and those are going to smoke and give the chicken a wonderful flavor. We're cooking the skin side first, marking it, cooking most of the fat out of it. And then we'll turn it over and cook the flesh side.
Talk me through another recipe that you just really treasured when you were in Anguilla.
Well, one of the best things to do was to go down and you get what they call a trunk fish. It has a exoskeleton, so it has a hard shell on the outside. And it's one of those fish that kind of
flops around the reef and floats around and has these kind of funny lips, almost like human lips. And they just go down there and they eat off the coral. And what they do is they come back, you throw them right on a barbecue, crack them open, put a little bit of seawater, a little fresh lime juice, and that's your dinner. That's how you cook
seawater?
Them. Yeah, so
seawater.
That's the salt. You know? Okay. So that is, you know, it's all about simplicity. All right, I'm just going to close this down. We'll let it cook for probably, I would say, another 4 or 5 minutes on the skin side. Flip it over, 4 or 5 minutes on the other side, and then turn the heat down and let it cook. And it takes about 25 minutes. A lot of people, if you want to speed it up a little bit, you could toss it in the microwave and par cook your chicken in the microwave. And that way it doesn't take as long on the grill, and you're also sure that it's going to be cooked through. But if you're buying real good fresh local chicken, you don't need to worry about it. But if you're buying chickens from a big box store or something, it's very important that you cook them all the way through. All right, let's give this a look.
It's looking good, nice and yellow.
Yeah, that's from that mellow yellow spice blend.
Oh, those tomatoes look gorgeous.
These are getting nice popped open. We can move these off to the side. Take a little look here. I've got some little fingerling potatoes I tossed with some a little bit of olive oil, salt, and pepper. We can put those on the grill. We're going to turn the heat down now and let it cook for about another 8 to 10 minutes. And then we'll be ready to slice it and serve.
All right.
Okay, you can see the potatoes have started to brown, got some nice little marks on them. Chicken, let's check it out. What I always like to do is to look between the tenderloin and the breast, and it should be cooked through. Okay, we'll arrange some tomatoes here on our service platter. Okay, and we got our potatoes, and now we'll slice up this chicken. And whenever you roast something or grill something, it's best to let it rest a little bit, which means just to take it off the grill and let it sit before you serve it. What's called carryover cooking, and that means that exterior of the bird or whatever meat you're cooking is going to be hotter than the interior. So you're allowing that excess heat to penetrate into the meat and to make sure that it's cooked. And if you do that, you'll tend not to have a dry chicken. Okay, you hold on to that. I got a real knife.
Oh,
that's not a knife. This is a knife. All right, so we'll slice that. All right, and here, have a little taste of that.
Okay.
Let me know if it's tender and moist.
That is both tender and moist.
And then after you take off the chicken from the grill, the Caribbeans aren't finished with it. Okay, and what they do to finalize it, a little more lime juice, okay, a little sea salt, okay, and then I'm going to add just a little bit of smoked paprika just because I love it. And get the margaritas going. It's time for a Caribbean chicken special.
Didn't catch all that? Follow the recipe on our website, eartheats.org. Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including Ben Alford, Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Stephen Hale, Liz Leslie, Michael Simmons, and everyone at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, therapeutic massage and hatha yoga, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. Memberships and gift certificates available. More at TouchstoneWellness.com. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Annie Corrigan.